chatting to some of the smaller kids as she got out a bucket of ice cubes and socks. They were finishing off a unit on temperature. She still looks tired.
Yes.
I should make her a coffee, Nona said decisively. I'm a teacher's aide. I need to look after the teachers too. And did you know she was a doctor?
Yes,
said Hot Sauce without explaining. And
when you're out there today, I want you to pretend to do something.
Okay. What?
I want you to pretend you've got a radio, said Hot Sauce, and you're making a call.
As Nona had never used a radio nor made a call in her life, she said dubiously,
It's not going to be very good. There's nothing out there shaped like a radio, so it'll have to be a pretend radio. And I'm not like Honesty. I can't do mime or anything.
Hot Sauce tapped her foot impatiently, her gaze still outside the window for some reason.
Pretend it's small, hand-sized.
What do I say?
Make something up, but hide your mouth.
When the angel approached with Noodle's leash in one hand and what looked to be six weird little cups in the other, she said, Don't stay out in the sunshine any more than you have to. He'll want to walk, so can you put his pattens on? My old man doesn't need burns on his feet. Noodle's used to the shoes, but tell him to stop if you see him chew his feet, and he'll stop. I'd keep him inside, except we'll be using the hairdryer today, and he always cringes at the sound. Thanks, Nona. You are my hero. Hot Sauce, can you set up the stations? Nona left the Hour of Science behind her and went down the stairs. She checked to make sure the light above the door was still red, which was one of her jobs, as the nice lady teacher always warned her that people would try to come in if the door was unlocked, and they probably wouldn't be dangerous. But if they had another teaching building get taken over by squatters, she simply had no idea where they'd go after that. Then Nona tried to put the shoes on Noodle. It was by far the most difficult thing she had ever attempted. It would have been easier to do the weird bone things that Camilla and Palamedes loved her to attempt. Noodle didn't want to have his pattens put on. He kept staring at Nona over his shoulder every time she wrestled a tiny, dirty white foot into a pattern. It was like a little sock over a plastic grate, and there were six of them. She even had to do the legs he often stuck up or folded in at the middle. At one point, Noodle cunningly wriggled his way out of one shoe using another foot, and Nona could have shrieked. She said, Noodle, how dare you? And he didn't look guilty at all. When the pattens were on, he clattered out into the courtyard. He sounded like 1.5 horses. He bucketed disconsolately around, smelling things, doing his business, and then drinking from the bowl of chilled water that Nona poured for him. Then he politely clattered away to lie under the big stone seat in the shade, panting. Nona ambled around the dusty courtyard for a bit herself, until she simply felt too hot to live. The heat and the sweat were making her feel faint. She squatted in the shadows close to Noodle's seat and listened to him breathe. And then she tried to pretend she was taking a very tiny radio out of her pocket. She cupped her hand to one ear and she walked out into the sunshine because she loved Hot Sauce and wanted to do it right. The heat made the backs of her knees panic.
Hello, hello, she said into her hand. I am having a conversation with Crown.
Nona remembered that she was meant to be covering her mouth and did so. She said aloud,
How are you, Crown? Things are fine over here. I wish you were around more. You haven't come to see me outside of meetings for months and months. I know you said you visited me before, but I was too young and I can't remember it, so it doesn't really count. Would you like to come to my birthday party on the beach? If I don't get really mad, it'll probably still be able to happen. You don't have to bring me a present, but please wear your hair down. Anyway, I love you, so bye.
This was as much conversation as she could think up. She pocketed the fake radio and took her hand away from her mouth. Then she settled down on the bench in the shade to think. The smoke had cleared, and so the air outside wasn't making her cough, and there were little insects haunting the nearby dead brown bushes, murmuring busily. There was no birdsong, but every so often there was the nice, comfortable noise of a car backfiring. Nona put one foot down on the ground to anchor herself, and worked the other foot out of her shoe, and only felt slightly guilty that she was allowed to do such a thing, and Noodle wasn't. It was so hot, and her eyelids felt very heavy, and the stone beneath her was very cool. John 15:23. He said,
"On the first day, A believed. On the second day, so did M and G. By the third day, everyone believed because of my eyes."
He coughed wetly and, once he had recovered, said,
"A girl in my high school once told me I had pretty eyes. I was puffed up over that until I was like 30. You wouldn't believe how stupid guys get over compliments on our looks. I was vain as. But my eyes weren't anything special. Light brown, not even hazel. Yellow on a sunny day. The morning after the lights went out, they lightened to dark amber. Then they went the colour of new lager, and on the third day they were gold. P said I looked like a Maori TV Pink Panther. C said I looked like Edward Cullen from that old Twilight movie, if Edward Cullen had the body of a history teacher. A said I looked cool. He was the only one.
He said,
and all around us, those corpses refused to rot."
In the dream, they were hiking up a big hill of brown, sun-blasted grass, crunching like paper beneath their feet. Below them, the waters were rising, but they ascended without hurry, unpanicked by that bubbling, churning brown morass. Those stupefying eddies frilled around the edges with trash of all kinds, broken trees and big sheets of steel, bobbing, groaning constructions of tyres and frames that he had pointed out as cars. He had spent some time pointing at things that were being claimed by the water, though she felt less that she was being taught their names, and more that he was naming them for himself.
Someone's Honda,
someone's Mazda, someone's four-wheel drive, someone's shed, a Macca's sign. The rain would turn on and off. The clouds were strange, and in the far distance, a twister danced on the neon surface of the sea. They found a bench to sit on, though they didn't need to catch their breath. It was warm despite the rain, and the air around them was moist and prickly. It made the skin on her ribs sweat. And he said,
"There it all goes again. I can't stand it."
And for a long time he cried, unashamed. Once that squall had passed, he said,
"In the beginning, we moved those corpses all over the place. M was so frantic to prove something in the science had gone wrong, or right. I think she thought if we'd achieved some scientific breakthrough, I'd get a job again and everything would go back to normal and we'd keep doing Cappuccino Tuesdays. We picked two of them. Two people, different sexes, different deaths. One got their neck snapped in a car accident, and the other was smoke inhalation. Same age, though, for control. They were born 20 days apart. Then we played dolls with those two kids for a week."
He said,
"They wanted to see if we could make them rot. We left them in the boiler room, left them in the morgue, left them outside overnight, exposed all over dew in the morning. Nothing changed. Their internal temperature stayed regular the whole time. It wouldn't change even with A and C holding hairdryers over their damn bodies or us wrapping them in solar blankets and putting them in the sun. Poor C. You should have seen her heave every time we unwrapped the blanket. She was a good sport about it, but it wasn't in her remit. Contract law doesn't set you up for rolling a couple of bodies into a pond."
He said,
"But she didn't need to worry about it. They didn't change. Not one thing about them changed. They were perfect. All those corpses were perfect.
He said,
I'd been sleeping in the facility already. I refused to go home. A and M moved in with me, and G set up outside. He was sleeping in his ute. C was staying with N, long days. She left us early in the morning and came back the next day with sausage rolls for breakfast. I didn't realise it at the time, but she'd already gone AWOL from the stakeholders. She was doing freelance for us. So, translated, she was unemployed. But she was the reason we could even stay in the building. She'd massaged all the contracts and told the cops we needed to be in there to make sure disposal and records were handled properly, which gave us a grace period of a whole month. How we got through that, I'll never know. I don't know if we would have got away with it if we hadn't had our pet cop. And if the whole world hadn't been freaking out every time you did something unexpected and people thought you were going to kick the bucket early. Nobody was looking at us back then, and we got lucky. It worked.
He said, more to himself.
Fuck, it was a weird time. I wasn't eating much. I only wanted to be with my bodies. Like, if I took my eyes off them, the magic would stop. I started knowing what room they'd been stashed in, even if no one told me. C said it was psychological clues in their body language, but I wasn't convinced. I could feel them. I could feel everyone in the building. It was like having the lights turned off. You hear all the sounds outside. You hear all the cicadas in the grass. You hear the dogs in the next town over barking. You hear the moorpawks in the trees and the possums skittering over shed roofs. It wasn't that I hadn't been able to hear them before, but I couldn't separate the noises. Like hearing a chord without knowing what notes go into it.
He said,
A was trying so hard to bring me back down to earth, trying to get me to pay attention to the outside world. He'd swapped with M. She'd stopped freaking out. She didn't ask me where my pills or the drink was anymore. She just took notes, helped with all the trials I wanted to do, squabbled with A. At least that made me feel normal. That was their usual double act. It was only when they felt the same thing that I knew it was serious.
He said,
I just wanted to be in the lab. It felt like I could sit by those two bodies, those two kids, and make time go away. I could sit next to them for 6 minutes. I could sit next to them for 6 hours. Just listening. They were my moorpawks and possums. I was hearing their bodies in all that silence. All the bacteria that weren't growing. What wasn't building up in the gut. What wasn't pooling at the joints. They were my silent night. I should have been doing paperwork and closing reports, but I hadn't opened the computer in days. I couldn't stop thinking about their palms, their hands. I touched their hands so often. I'd touched their hands before, but not like this. Even when I wasn't touching them, I could feel their skin on my skin. That temperature that wouldn't change. I kept thinking I was touching them when I wasn't. M said I should probably get tossed in a rubber room. But she wasn't scared I was nuts. She was scared I wasn't.
He said,
you know, I can't even remember how it came together now. There was no catalyst, no revelation. I was too far gone for revelations. It was like I'd been dozy and now I was waking up. So my two kids, the guinea pigs, they were U and T on their certificates, you know, their old names. I thought about using those, but it didn't seem appropriate. They weren't around to say yes or no. I was starting to really care about that. What they would have thought, what they would have wanted.
My two kids with their frozen brains and their perfect internal temperatures. There wasn't a place on the poor bastards I hadn't breached with a thermometer, and now I was knocking before I came into their room. Yeah, I was nuts, but I was waking up. He said, I can't remember how or why I brought M and A into the room. I was like, hey, you two, I want you to meet someone. I wasn't trying to be a dick. I think I hadn't slept for 2 days. So I brought them into the room with the bodies, and I was all, let me introduce you to Ulysses. Let me introduce you to Titania. He thought about it and added, I better say that it was Titania from Midsummer, Shakespeare, but Ulysses was for a dog my Nana had when I was a child. I worshipped that dog. He was the bravest dog I had ever met. Half Chihuahua, half pug. Nan called him Ulysses S. Grunt. Died from eating too much pizza. The dog, I mean. Nan died of pneumonia when I was a teenager.
She said, but what about the bodies?
He said, well, when I said Ulysses, I moved each of his fingers and his thumb into a fist, curled them into the palm, and when I said, this is Titania, same thing. I placed each of her fingers and her thumb into a fist, and I was laughing and laughing like I'd kicked out a chair before someone sat down, like, good joke. But M threw up. Because, Harrow, I'd done it from the other side of the room.
9.
Nona jolted awake with a start when she felt a tender slobbering on her ankle. It was Noodle's terrible licky tongue investigating the bit where the bone of her foot made a bump, which she obviously thought was a friendly gesture. She could have only been asleep for a little while. The sun hadn't moved, and the big hot blue shadows of the courtyard were shimmering in the same position they always had. But she startled herself upright anyway, freaking out that she had snored away most of the hour of science without taking care of Noodle, or even looking for whoever was watching the building. She checked Noodle to make sure his patterns were on, retrieved the bowl and the bottle, and took the dog inside. She was very relieved to hear the angel's voice coming through the door and floating down the stairs, explaining why the ice cube in the sock had melted more slowly than the ice cube not in the sock. She sat down on the stairs and began assisting Noodle out of his pattens. Nona had assumed Noodle would be grateful, but he still turned around and showed her the whites of his eyes, despite the fact that she was now taking him out of the pattens rather than putting them on, and he wriggled. The cloakroom door opened and out came Hot Sauce.
"What did you say?" she demanded.
Nona was bewildered.
"What did I say when?" "Out in the courtyard." "Oh, nothing," said Nona, barely able to remember. "I wasn't good at pretending to talk at all. I just pretended I was talking to someone else, and I only talked for like 10 seconds because I felt silly."
Hot Sauce did not look convinced.
"Better come inside early. We've used the hairdryer."
"What happened when I talked on the radio?" Hot Sauce hesitated, then said,
"The watcher took off."
"Well, that's good, isn't it? Right?
I need to investigate.
But it's useful to know, isn't it?" But when Hot Sauce shrugged, Nona could tell she thought Nona didn't understand, knew that Hot Sauce was keeping things back. Something she didn't mind as much when Hot Sauce did it, but still minded a little. It was shitty being able to tell when people were holding back from her. Hot Sauce just said, "Come inside." It wasn't a great end to the school day, and it seemed to jinx everything from there on. Nona, sitting at the back with Noodle, found she couldn't follow what was happening in the hour of science, which culminated in a lot of ice cubes removed from strange places to triumphant shrieks from the crowd. And then there was the familiar pop-pop-pop from the street, really close, so they had to close all the blinds, and the nice lady teacher had to go downstairs to make sure everything was locked up, and they did everything sitting down away from shot lines from the window.
They'd all done gunfire drill a million times, and hardly any of the tinies got scared, even when the dreary siren started up outside. It was more boring and hot than it was terrifying. Even the angel only seemed annoyed.
"That's too close for comfort," she commented. "Probably a one-off."
But it wasn't a one-off. It kept happening. They cut off any plenary time and mopped up ice water, and the main teacher read to them from a book after a vote. The tinies outvoted everyone to select a book that wasn't even good, a soppy tale about some children who went to the beach and weren't eaten by anything. Another sign of the afternoon being cursed, Nona thought dolefully. At least school was nearly over for her. People's parents snuck in, despite the fact that there was still shooting going on a couple streets away. Some of them said that it had been like that for hours, and their child wouldn't come back for afternoon school, even though both the angel and the nice lady teacher tried to get them all to stay until it was better. They were still arguing when Camilla came to pick up Nona, and even though the lady teacher's eyes brightened to see Cam, Nona could see her pamphlet hand twitching. Cam bundled her out of there before she even got a proper goodbye. The last thing she saw was Hot Sauce sitting by the blinded-up window, thoughtful and still as a statue in the park, only her head was still on, of course. Camilla led Nona by a very circuitous way home. They stopped at the street their building was on, and Cam ducked into a bakery and came out with a warm and probably radioactive paper bag of pastries that had been under the bakery light the whole time. When Nona asked how she got the money, Cam said, "Never mind." Nona was annoyed.
"You can just say you stole some, Cam. I don't mind."
"I sold something," said Camilla. Light dawned on Nona back home after she had choked down some of the meat roll. She tried not to complain about it, but did the thing where she drank water until she said, "I'm full." And Cam said, "Then we'll wait. You haven't had any protein today." And she had to eat it anyway. She peeled off the casing and ate the stuff inside and hated the experience, but at least then it was over. While Cam was cleaning up, she checked the secret drawer and found that the cigarettes were all gone. When Camilla came back in to tack up the blackout curtains, Nona said,
"You sold her stash. Pyrrha's going to freak out."
"Pyrrha will deal," said Camilla. "Start stretching." Which meant it was time for swords. When Nona said passionately,
"I hate swords. You don't even teach me how to use them."
This just got written down on the clipboard as though even her complaints were only useful for research. Nona felt very bitter about life. But her bitterness slowly ebbed away, as it always did, and turned into something a little more like misery. Pyrrha was late coming home that evening. It had used to be that, after the bones and the swords, Nona would spend sultry evenings out at the harbour, to swim if the beach was empty and if there was nobody there to see, or to dig clams and cockles out with a stick if there were people. Walking made her tired, but she could swim in the salt water for hours and never get enough of it. It was comfortable and private. Unfortunately, these days, if she said,
"Cam, can't we go swimming?"
Cam would say, "Remember what happened the last time," and won every argument that way. That was because what happened the last time was that Camilla had got sick, and, less important, Nona had got shot. What had happened was that after the bones one day, Palamedes said she looked peaky and made her eat crackers and spread until Nona worked herself halfway to a tantrum. In the end, Palamedes had to promise her a swim for a whole 20 minutes before she would do anything, eat anything, or agree to anything. It was bad behaviour, but Nona had been a whole month younger. Promises made, Palamedes got to go away, saying, "Tell Cam I said it was a water cure," to which Camilla remarked that Palamedes was an enabler. It didn't matter to Nona. She had already got her towel and the old shirt she used to swim in. Much easier to go naked, but the others had all objected to this, and Cam had said it would make her a sniper target, and her jandals, and then, after masks were tied and hats put on, they walked to the beach in the low dusk. That evening they had walked around the long way, which meant it took fully half an hour to get there. But often they walked different routes to throw off anyone who might have gotten interested and tried to follow them. On this walk they ended up spending a little time by the city graveyard. All the concrete tops had been sledged open, and the buried coffins had been dug up, piled high and burned. The smoke still clung to the sides of the buildings and made Nona gag. Pyrrha had told her this was business as usual. Pyrrha said the first thing that happened was all bones got burned, whether they were moving around or not. By the time they had gotten to the beach, Nona was depressed. But it only took her feet being in the salt water to make her happy again. Camilla never came in with her. This was because there were heaps and heaps of jellyfish in the harbour, with their beautiful bodies transparent at the crown and deep indigo at the very tips, and they weren't at all afraid to come up near to you and brush you. On Nona, this made the place they touched tingle a little, but nothing else. That was why Nona had always swum at dusk, because Cam said the jellyfish sting killed most people within minutes. The water seethed with them because the harbour was closed and nobody was fixing the barrier nets. Instead, Cam sheltered near the concrete pillars of a jetty, out of sightlines, with a beat-up paperback book. It had been earlier in the spring, and night had fallen fast. There was no electric light, so she had a little torch. The first time Nona had asked to swim, they had let her without cavil. She had barely known how to explain herself then, but her hunger was so terrible that she had made them all understand. For security, Camilla had taken handfuls of rocks and sailed each one up into the centre of the lamps that shone down from the pier, with a terrific smash of plastic and the brief snappish yowl of a busted wire, and nobody had come around to fix them since. They wouldn't have had time. The blue light had appeared in the sky soon after. It had been high tide that night. Nona had gone wading out into the shallows immediately, picking her way over the big pockmarked rocks and the slippery seaweed clumps floating haplessly in the surf until she was up to her thighs, the shirt billowing around her. Then she plunged into the salt water. She let herself go under and felt the huge, rocking cradle of the waves rolling her forward to the beach, nearly weeping with relief. Like going to the bathroom when you were really desperate, or drinking when you were really thirsty, or hearing the door open when you were really lonely. The black water sank right down to the roots of her hair, right through the braids, and made her ears go pop as water blocked up the canals. Bubbles rippled across her face as her laugh came out as oxygen. She kicked up to the surface and her hair and her shirt floated all around her in the water, and she bobbed there in the dark, avoiding the inviting yellow squares of light that the other jetty lamps made on the roiling surface. Then she had clung to one of the wooden legs of the pier, bubbled all over with barnacles and crusted with salt and plastered with dried-out fans of seaweed, and watched as blue jellyfish moved about her, squirting through the water or drifting there, looking dead, until suddenly they would undulate forward in delicate blue squiggles of movement. She did get stung, but the sting only gave her pins and needles in one foot, which was soon over. She pushed off from the pillar again and into a wave, and let the tide carry her forward slowly to the rocky shore. Salt water had always relieved her. Salt water made her feel as though, if there was someone in there with her, she would suddenly know the words to tell them everything. The sea was so kind after a hot, concrete-smelling day, and she knew the water had runoff in it, but it seemed so clean anyway. The sea was a big, grinding, unchangeable machine. The only terrible part was an awful longing to let her head go below the surface, to lose all buoyancy and lie at the bottom like a flat fish. Nona didn't want to die, but she wanted to sit in the water and drowse, which she was forced to admit was the same thing eventually. That fatal evening she lay with her arms and legs spread out and her middle only a little submerged, shirt plastered flat to her belly and chest. She stared up at the glowing blue circle in the night sky. It crowded out the stars and looked much like an incandescent jellyfish itself, crowning in a black ocean. Nona had been very happy when she turned around and kicked back toward the jetty and the shore, slipping among the waves and the foam and the floating plastic rings people used to keep bottles together. It felt so easy to be good when you were happy. Nona had been ready to eat as many meals as Camilla wanted her to, so long as the number was less than three. She had made it to the end of the pier, and Camilla was clear in her view. And a big shock went right down her spine when she saw her, not because it was Camilla, but because she was not alone. There was a little cluster of figures in tatty coats spread out on the beach on the side they'd come in on. Nona counted six of them. They looked black-headed, but when Nona squinted, she saw that they were wearing goggles and caps or wraps around their heads. One of them was holding one of those little motorised bikes that you often saw going plut-plut down the streets of the city. It was turned off now, except for the lamp, which was on full brightness. The suds and the waves filled her ears, and she could not make out what anyone was saying, if they were saying anything. It was impossible to see their mouths. Easy enough to see Camilla, silhouetted in the lamp of the plup-plup bike, strung across one of the supports beneath the pier like a sinuous night animal. The beam was hot and white and bright, and Camilla hovered within it like a moth. Nona assumed it was the police. Only the police got to have those bikes, but still couldn't afford good jackets. Each one had a shoulder holster, which meant each one had a short gun, and they stood in a kind of triangular gaggle, with one right at the point before Camilla. Nobody's guns were drawn, but the holsters were out in the open, each a kind of glittering mechanical bulge at the top of the chest. Camilla had put her hands out in a beseeching, "No guns here" kind of a way. The light made the wrist strap watch on her arm glitter. She swung her legs down off her pillar to land in a little puff of sand, with one hand still raised. She rummaged around in her pocket, threw something down on the ground, backed off. One of the figures ducked forward and picked it up. Nona kept the water right up to her eyes and began to approach. Made it to the next pole in the jetty, and the pole after that. But Camilla tucked her hair behind one ear, as though she was nervous, and flashed her palm out to the jetty. One thumb tucked in, four fingers spread. That was the sign to stay put. Nona hesitated, then stayed put. There was a lot of discussion in the triangle about whatever had been picked up. It could have been a perfectly ordinary conversation, albeit a conversation between six people with guns in a triangle and one person with her hands up. Camilla was so bad at staying still. Even as they talked, she stretched in that cold white circle of light, one foot pressing down into the sand, and then the other, slowly and deliberately and liquidly. Nona swam to the nearest pillar, found her footing on a big metal screw, and waited, buffeted by the waves and the brushing lappets of three comfortably stinging jellyfish. She still couldn't make out what they were saying. One of the police had thrown the object back down into the sand in front of Camilla. Nona could see it better now. It was Cam's wallet. Had they asked for papers or something? Camilla didn't retrieve it. Then all at once, one of the cops at the back drew their gun. Nona threw herself forward into the water and shot. The muzzle flashed. Camilla hadn't fallen down. She hadn't been hit. The bullet had gone wide past her shoulder, and she hadn't moved, hadn't ducked, hadn't done anything except keep her hands up. Nona kicked silently to the pillar in front, where she could hear snatches of conversation.
"Said scare her."
"Did what you..."
"Speak, house," Camilla was saying.
The figure at the front made their mouth look different and said, exaggeratedly loudly and clearly,
"Try again. Unjust Hope says..." but the waves took the rest. Camilla said something Nona didn't catch at all. The cop turned around and said, mouth different again,
"Put a bullet in her this time."
The one with the gun responded, sounding garbled. But the first figure said clearly,
"Get the knee, I'm sick of this,"
and something else. Nona had broken. Her only use was translating, and there she was, listening to the most important conversation that had ever been had, and she was not translating. She had surged out of the water and shrieked,
"Run! They're going to shoot you!"
And instead of shooting Camilla, the cop with the gun aimed right into the dark water and shot Nona. It felt like someone had punched her in the shoulder, hard. Nona did as Pyrrha had taught her and went completely limp. For a moment, her shoulder felt hot and awkward, and there was a hot burst of blood over her arm, feeling weird against the cool salt water. A yellow light shot through the waves like a dropped egg, and she writhed in its silhouette briefly before deciding to sink right down to the bottom. The light arced back and forth, swinging around, never finding her. She counted to 20, glad she had taken a big breath, waiting there at the bottom and clutching the black rocks. It was very murky. Every so often a questing jellyfish would bob into view, and she had to bat it away from her face. She thought she heard a brief report, coming thickly from far away, as though maybe someone had pushed the part of the bike that went honk. Then there were weird white lights, quick, darting, moving lights, like very small fireworks. But Nona kept what Pyrrha called firing discipline. Only at the end of the long 20 seconds did she kick away, launching herself forward along the rocky bottom until she hit one of the jetty pillars. By that time, the pain and the weird feeling were over. The bullet had gone clean through the topmost part of her arm, which was good, and there wasn't even a hole to show where it had been. She felt a little sick, but that was all. Nona had never been shot before. She inched up the pillar until her head broke water. The beach had gone very quiet. The plup-plup bike's headlights still shone out in her direction, blinding her a little. As Nona's eyes adjusted, she saw Camilla squatting on the sand. Everyone else was fanned out, lying down around her, as though they had all decided to take a school-time nap. Nona waded through the water, heart racing, struggling through the surf, thrashing upward through the shallows, pulling herself to stand. Her feet felt numb, but looking back, that was probably the jellyfish. Each and every single person who wasn't Camilla was down on the ground. Their unholstered guns were still clutched in their hands or scattered loosely near them. The sand underneath each one was oily black. It hadn't been that hot, but wisps of steam curled up from the dark, wet sand. Camilla was crouched down, wiping her knives on one of their jackets. When she looked up, Nona was electrified. One of her eyes was a pale, pearlescent grey. The other one of her eyes was a deep, cool stone colour. Nona understood in a sudden shiver what she was looking at. "Stay calm," said Camilla and Palamedes. "Five breaths if you need it." Camilla and Palamedes' voice was strange to her, cool and efficient, distantly kind. But Nona wasn't angry. The air smelled strongly of smoke and burnt meat. It made her deeply unhappy and very hungry, even though she had forced down all those crackers.
"I thought if I played dead," Nona began, and stopped, because a big lump had come into her throat. She felt stupid. She felt she was being ungrateful. When Camilla and Palamedes smiled that strange new person smile, she suddenly felt very shy.
But Camilla's clockwork interrupted with a series of urgent beeps, the beep, 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 beep of a timer alarm, faster and more panicked than the usual time's up sound. Camilla Palamedes got up all of a sudden, as though they wanted to get getting up over and done with as quickly as possible, and swayed backward and forward a little. The blood on the beach was steaming. Their hands were steaming.
Nona struggled forward to catch her, them, the new person. But then Camilla straightened and blinked furiously. And it was Camilla. Her eyes were pale grey again and she shuddered like herself. She said a little hoarsely, but in quite normal Camilla tones, "Not your fault." Then she equally normally set to putting her knives away, sticking them in the bands down her thighs, inside her trousers. And normally seeing that made Nona want to laugh. But that night she felt as though she might vomit instead, which would have added insult to injury. Camilla said, "Shoulder." She didn't sound angry at all, but strangely quiet and tight.
"It's fine. I'm fine."
"Cam, what did you do?"
"No questions. They didn't have silencers. We need to go. Get the bike."
Nona wasn't able to help herself. She burst out with,
"What did they want?"
"Intel. They were Merv Wing. Turn the lights off."
The spotlight was still shining out over the ocean like a very small moon. Nona righted the plup-plup bike and turned off the headlight, which left the beach blue and cold. She kept looking at the fallen cops, at their necks and at their chests. But Camilla gently drew her chin up and away, urging her forward, putting the towel around her wet shoulders. It felt nice and dry and scratchy. Nona mechanically wheeled the bike over the sand. Cam threw down her jandals and she squeezed her feet into them, the sand gritty on the bottoms of her heels. Camilla didn't say anything. She had zipped up her dark jacket, even though the night was still warm, and Nona thought she understood. She was cold too, colder than she ought to have been, even when wet. Camilla kept her arms folded tight over her chest as though she was thinking. Nona was too sodden with regret and self-hatred and seawater to think about anything but that Cam must have been very angry with her for calling out, and so she was blind to the truth of the situation until they wheeled the bike off the ramp and weaved it through the poles that were meant to prevent you bringing bikes onto the beach. And Camilla suddenly staggered to a halt. She leant hard against the wall and shuddered. Nona nearly dropped the bike.
"Cam?"
"Towel," said Camilla very calmly, and, "Don't scream."
Nona was about to be indignant, but then Cam unzipped her jacket and she nearly screamed. Cam's thin cotton top was sodden with blood. The tops of her pants and her whole jacket were already black and wet from spray, so it hadn't really showed the blood coming through. The worst part was that the blood was coming from everywhere, with no wounds or bullet holes or stab marks. It was coming out of her skin. Cam rubbed the towel down both of her arms briskly. The towel came away bright red.
"Blood sweat," she said unsteadily.
"Get Palamides," was all Nona could think to say. "Get Palamides. He can fix it."
"No," said Camilla.
Nona noticed that her lips had gone the same colour as the skin around them, a sort of ashen rosy brown, instead of either skin or lips being normal. Cam's voice was still very even and calm, but it was quiet and came out strangely punctuated as she took in breaths.
"He can't. Not this. Make it worse."
"But..."
"Get us home," said Camilla. "You can do it. On the bike."
"The bike?"
Yet it was not to be borne that Nona would say,
"But my car sickness."
If Camilla said anyone could do anything, they could do it. It was not the kind of thing she said often, or at all. It was more buoyed by the sucker punch of Camilla's belief than through her own confidence. She suddenly needed to go to the bathroom, which Palamides always said was her displacement activity, that Nona got on the bike. Her courage had nearly failed her when Camilla got behind her and wrapped her arms around Nona's middle, very tightly. Nona had realised then that Cam was worried about falling off. Even thinking about it now, how Nona drove Cam through those black streets she did not know, ignoring all the traffic signals, slowing down laboriously to turn into the little side alleys, the lone truck breaking curfew that chugged along the street next to her like a massive animal of hot wind and noise. But she did, and it took both forever and no time at all. Camilla was very warm and solid behind her, with her arms unflinchingly tight. She never released the grip, which was nice, until Nona realised that half the warmth was the blood seeping through the towel. She was about to guide the bike into the garage beneath the building before Cam said, "Dump it, here," in a voice barely more than a whisper. "Here" was behind a big rubbish cache next to the building. Cam stood herself against the wall, and Nona wheeled it into the gap behind the cache and the wall, then covered the gap up with boxes. She was pleased with the neatness of it until she came back to Camilla and saw the deathly pallor of her face. The stillness that was not Palamedes, but Camilla conserving all of her blood for silence. In the black night time of that alley, the towel around Camilla's middle was black with blood, and the seawater and blood had dried on Nona's clothes. She put Camilla's arm around her shoulders and they crept into the garage, each breath from Cam's mouth high and tight. It was so strange to hear Camilla breathing at all. Somehow they made it up the stairs. Of course, the elevator didn't work, and Nona was almost too slippery and panicky to knock. When Pyrrha opened the door, all Nona was able to say was pitifully, "No, no, no!" like the baby she had been. But what a relief it was at the time to give things over to Pyrrha. Pyrrha had carried Camilla to bed in her big brown arms like Cam weighed nothing, was less than Nona. Pyrrha said, "What happened?" and Nona told her, and Pyrrha wasn't even angry. But when Nona told her about Cam's eyes, she looked at Nona and said a completely new swear word. It was such an unusual swear word that later on Nona was able to swap it to honesty for 5 whole cigarettes, he was that impressed. Pyrrha sat down with Cam's head in her lap and pinched her awake, and then made her drink little sips of water. Cam's eyes were almost closed, like an animal's when they weren't quite asleep. The water brought her around a little. Pyrrha kept saying, low and steady, "Don't black out, kid. You're in a thanergy shock. Stay awake. Come on." After about 5 minutes of that treatment, Cam's eyes opened all the way, and she drank the rest of the water, mostly on her own. She let Nona give her a painkiller, but just a cap, not a needle. In the end, Pyrrha said in a calm, dead voice, "You can't do that ever again, Hecht. Never. Synthesis is a one-way ticket. I walked the Eightfold, I should damn well know. I'd give Palamedes the hiding of his fucking life if he wasn't renting an ass with you." Camilla, cradled in Pyrrha's arms, with all the towels bright red, looked up at Pyrrha like Nona wasn't even in the room. Her eyes were chill and grey and gleaming. She whispered, "Don't tell him I was weak." "He's going to know, Hecht. You're killing each other." "It's our choice." "He's going to ask." "Do what you're good at," said Camilla. "Lie." "Hecht, you're not listening. It's killing him, too." "It was good," said Camilla, and her eyes closed. "It was good. We were happy." Pyrrha stayed put until Camilla fell asleep. The expression on her face was one Nona had never seen her wear before. Nona stayed too, except to go occasionally to the bathroom out of prolonged stress. Finally, Pyrrha told Nona to go make up her bed next to Pyrrha's on the fold-out part of the couch. And when Nona asked if Camilla was going to be all right, Pyrrha said, "No." But when she saw the expression on Nona's face, she put on a smile, produced one, like she would produce sweets or coins or little magazines, and said, "Don't worry about it, Junior. I don't mean we're going to find her dead in the morning." Then she had gone to the kitchen and poured herself a little glass of clear grain alcohol. She crossed to the taped-up window, bottle and glass in hand. To Nona's awe, she twitched the blackout curtains aside, stood bathed in the hyper-blue light from the sky as Nona held her breath, and she said to the window,
"Here's to Camilla Hecht, yet another of devotion's casualties," and knocked back the glass.
Then she said to the light quite gently,
"No, I don't blame you, man. He was always looking for things to throw himself on."
Then Pyrrha settled down on the bed she had extended for Nona and knocked back two more little glasses of alcohol. She let Nona taste a little bit of the second glass when Nona asked, but Nona thought it was awful. It tasted like petrol and felt like sunburn. When she lay down, she kept wiping her lips to take the taste away.
"If Cam's fine," she said, "why did you just say goodbye to her?"
"How do you know it was goodbye?"
When Nona opened her mouth, Pyrrha said,
"Don't answer that. Go to sleep."
And after that, there had been no more swimming.
10.
Going to the beach, though, if there was still lots of light and plenty of people, was another matter. Nona tried her luck. "No beach," said Cam, drying dishes at the sink. "I didn't like the city today. Two people got shot in the centre while I was there. Someone else got dragged out of the river."
"Drowned?"
"Strangled. Neck snapped all the way around."
"Gross," said Nona,
and, struck by an idea,
"Cam, can't I go back to school for the evening?"
"School? Why?" Nona tried to think up a really intelligent and persuasive reason.
"Hot Sauce is worried about something," she said. "She said someone was watching the classroom and she wouldn't tell me about it. I want to make sure they're all okay."
It wasn't that Camilla didn't take this seriously. She could see right away that Cam had taken it a little too seriously. Her dark brows drew together a fraction, and she placed another plate in the rack, and one of her legs folded up beneath her so that she was standing on one leg and resting the other foot on the top of that thigh. "Not in the dark," she said. "Not after the gunfire today."
"But it's not dark yet, and the sky's always sort of light now."
"It'll be dark enough by the time school's over." Nona grew desperate.
"But I'm a teacher's aide. I've got a responsibility."
"I know," said Camilla, lowering the foot, then raising the other. "It's also your responsibility to keep yourself safe. Responsibilities clash." Nona felt hot and cross.
"It's hard to feel responsible for the other two people I might be," she said, knowing she sounded crabby and not knowing how not to. "I don't know them, but I feel very responsible for Hot Sauce and Honesty and Ruby and Bourne and even Kevin, and I've only got so much time, you know. Maybe the other two people I am would feel incredibly responsible for Hot Sauce and the others too, Cam."
"Oh, one of them definitely," said Camilla, "and maybe the other. I don't mean you've got a responsibility to them. You have a responsibility to me and the warden and to Pyrrha." In desperation, Nona flung herself down on the soft mat on the floor she and Cam had been using for stretches.
"Cam, responsibility just means you can't ever do anything you think is really important."
"Yes," said Cam simply, and, "Let's stop waiting for Pyrrha and go pick up dinner." They walked to the fish shop so that Nona could look longingly at the ocean and listened to the fishmonger explain the latest about the port riots so that Nona could later translate for Cam. "Nice girls with no guns needed to stay inside," urged the fishmonger. The space elevator had gotten breached about an hour ago because too many loyalist soldiers had been rerouted to the barracks siege, and the old workers had busted through with a keycard trying to hijack a shuttle off-world. Most of them had been shot, and there were no shuttles there anyway. There were no shuttles anymore. When Nona relayed this to Camilla, she said,
"Hope Pyrrha takes the back roads."
"Will Pyrrha be okay, Cam?"
"Pyrrha's a survivor,"
said Camilla.
But she let Nona slip her hand into hers, and they walked shoulder to shoulder all the way home, with the plastic foam container of spicy rice and oily fish hot and steamy in the crook of Nona's arm. It had been very cheap. People weren't eating the harbour fish, because they said that the blue light got into them. They said the blue light got into the air, too, and they wore masks for that, though Palamedes said that was nonsense. Cam ate most of the fish and rice as Nona picked at the edges, and then there was all the fruit they hadn't eaten for afters. Nona's plate was left still mostly full, despite one genuine effort to eat and two not-so-genuine ones where she faked it. "You can eat three more mouthfuls, or two, and drink some water," said Camilla, inflexibly.
"But I've eaten so much today."
"You ate gruel and a sausage roll."
"But I'm full. I'm really full."
"Have you been eating sand again?"
"I haven't eaten sand in months," Nona protested. Then, more truthfully, "weeks." And more truthfully than that, "1 week."
Nona eventually took the deal where she drank a glass of water and ate two more mouthfuls. As it turned out, though, she never had to eat the second, because the special knock sounded. 5 short, 2 long, which they changed often, and Cam unlocked and unbarred the door for Pyrrha. Pyrrha looked terrible. Her deep skin was powdered with concrete dust and shiny with smoke, splotched with rusty patches on the front that it took Nona a moment to realise were blood. She reeked of petrol and sweat. Cam recognised the red stuff immediately and started trying to check Pyrrha over, tugging at her overalls, her arms. Pyrrha said swiftly, "It's not mine," and dropped into one of the chairs at the kitchen table. Nona got up and went to pour her a glass of ice water from the covered jug. Pyrrha said, "Thanks, Noms," and drained the whole thing. Nona, fascinated, watched the brown column of her throat move as she swallowed. There was already a fine dark rust of stubble beneath her chin, amid the dust and the dirt, and when Pyrrha caught her looking, she felt there with her hand and said, laughing,
"I know, I know. Gideon always had a 5 o'clock shadow at 3 o'clock. Sextus, can't you fix it? If you kick the sebaceous glands back a notch, you can interrupt the hair cycle. Quick injection of Thanergy below the root will freeze the growth."
Pyrrha's eyes were hot and shiny, and her pupils blown wide. Nona hadn't even seen Cam and Palamedes switch. Palamedes was busy rolling up one of Pyrrha's sleeves, examining a slimy patch of scabbing over blood, and he said briskly,
"No, thanks. I had the joy of working on a body like yours the once, and I don't want to repeat the process for anything smaller than a brain hemorrhage. What hit this forearm?"
"Vehicle shrapnel. They were taking pot shots at the police, and the police took pot shots back with a munitions launcher."
Pyrrha held the glass out beseechingly to Nona. Nona went and refilled it.
"Don't worry. I squatted in a public bathroom and forked everything out myself. It's mostly closed up already."
"Did you?"
"Saved who I could. Left the rest to be buried," said Pyrrha. "Or burned. Lots of them were burning. Couldn't do anything for them. People notice when you don't burn is the thing. There was an audience. Others have been killed for less."
Palamedes said nothing. He pushed at a pair of glasses that didn't exist, made a noise of annoyance, and swept his hand lightly over the arm. Nona, fascinated, watched the blood peel away and frizzle to nothing, leaving a long zigzag of clean, open meat on Pyrrha's arm that was wrinkling shut as they watched. Nona said,
"Was it the port riot? Were you there?"
"You heard about that, kiddie?"
"No," said Pyrrha. "It's just aftershocks. I was on that side of the city as all."
Palamedes said, "Is it finally kicking off?"
"Not yet."
Pyrrha curled her arm inward, examining the disappearing wound, and took the cool glass from Nona's hands.
Her fingers had left dirty fingerprints on the glass.
I know that sounds ridiculous, but not yet. Even though they're chucking bombs at the cops and yelling shit about no deals, no lords, no zombies, and cops love zombie money. When it kicks off, nobody will be yelling anything. This is anger, not fear. False labor pains.
Do they still do gravid carry, where you come from? On the 6th, only for research, said Palamedes.
I helped at a birth once.
There's a lot of noise and run-up before the real thing happens. Pyrrha necked the second glass of water all the way down and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand before she could think better of it. When she saw the result, she grimaced. Nona fetched a damp cloth without being asked, so that Pyrrha could start to clean up.
This has been a shit day. I'm having a cigarette. I'll smoke it out the window.
Nona froze, but Palamedes said calmly,
No good.
Come sold them. Said they were our most liquid asset. She expected Pyrrha to get very sarcastic.
Pyrrha didn't yell, ever. But Nona experienced so much yelling among her friends that she deeply preferred it. Pyrrha just sighed. Deeply.
How much did she get?
Maybe a third of what they were worth.
What an entirely haunted time to be alive, said Pyrrha.
Nona, my sweet, can you draw me a berth? My filth's got filth.
Nona sprinted to the bath and put the plug in the plug hole and dutifully started grating the soap bar into fine, dusty flakes to put in the hot water, not even minding leaning over the sweaty hot water tap. But she pricked up her ears when she heard, in the other room, Palamedes saying softly,
I'm going to let Camilla look you over.
Tell her what you told me.
And Pyrrha saying,
Wait a moment, Warden. Wait. I want you to hear this first, not Hecht. I need you to stop Hecht, okay? I need you to hold her back.
Nona shut off the hot water tap. It wasn't as though she was deliberately trying to eavesdrop. She was still carefully holding the paring knife and trying to make the longest unbroken rind of soap that she could, watching flakes disappear and dissolve into white scum on the surface of the water. Her hair was itchy with sweat. She heard Palamedes say,
Oh, God, Pyrrha, just tell me.
Pyrrha said,
In the chaos, they found some people to take to the park tonight.
There was a very long silence, or else Nona couldn't hear. Pyrrha said,
I saw them for 2-3 seconds in the back of a truck. 3 adults. It was dark. Said they'd taken them off the corpse. One person I asked said they'd been in the barracks. Another one said they'd found them wild.
Nona couldn't wait any more. She ran the cold water tap before she died of being too hot, and let the water run over her wrists and her palms like Camilla had taught her. Wrists were the best place for cooling down. That meant she only caught fragments until Pyrrha and Palamedes helpfully made their voices louder.
You versus 200 motherfuckers with machine guns? Camilla versus 200 motherfuckers with machine guns sexters! I know you and she are doing some ungodly tricks with soul manipulation, but what do you think you are, a damned L-word? You're not even a fraction of one. You're only a step in the theory. The poor fools they have probably aren't even...
How many people do you leave to burn tonight, Dvay?
You say that because you think it hurts, and because you're frightened, said Pyrrha coolly. The answer, my boy, is multitudes. So long as it doesn't include you and me and Nona. We're all three of us in enough trouble as it is. Don't make me repeat myself.
Pyrrha, they tape their arms to their sides and they put them in those cages and they douse them in petrol, in gasoline.
Yes.
And then they set them alight, and it's terrible. And usually somebody shoots them long before the fire takes them.
There's always some softy in the crowd, Sextus, even for zombies. And it won't be zombies. Listen to me. What I've been trying to tell you this whole night is that me and the boys combed Sightsea, and I found nothing. No bodies, no blood, none of your people. No sign they were even kept there by Edenites. This is the public taking it out on a couple of poor bastards they pick up who are insane or drug-addled or who said the wrong thing and gave someone a wonderful opportunity to get them out of the way. You know that's been the vast majority of the cage deaths since the initial flush. Even if it is one of yours, the number 7 will have them so out of their tree that they'll hardly notice when... This isn't about house loyalty, said Palamedes quietly. It's about 3 people being burnt to death. There was a big silence. Nona made a number of tiny noises, cleaning the paring knife, cleaning her hands, making sure Pyrrha's towel was dry. Pyrrha said, Keep Camilla home tonight. I'll call it quits for the 6. Palamedes said, Do you know she has a half-sister? Did she tell you? It's not my secret to tell. They're quite fond of each other. Camilla's 10 years younger. Kiki's a member of Oversight Body, junior fellow. She was one of the group that came to negotiate with Tessaphon Wing. I didn't know that, no, said Pyrrha. Alongside 15 other of the finest minds of my house, said Palamedes, led here by my conviction and Camilla's hand. My colleagues, my friends, my family. The people they put in cages will be someone's family, someone's friends. Keep Camilla home tonight, said Pyrrha. That is all I am saying. Keep her home. No heroics. I'm not moved by sentiment. Whatever it takes, don't feel, just do. Tonight I hate almost all the human race, said Palamedes wearily. That's a feeling, said Pyrrha brutally. Kill it.
Palamedes did not seem to notice when Nona crept back into the kitchen, drying her hands on her front. He had ducked into the bedroom. It was just Pyrrha, peeling her bloodied shirt off and putting it in the sink to soak. Pyrrha, with her naked chest so moth-eaten with scars that even Camilla and Palamedes couldn't guess the cause of. Nona always felt soft and tender when she saw Pyrrha with her shirt off, and liked to rest her head on her back between her prominent shoulder blades. But tonight she just said humbly, Can I go into the corridor for 5 minutes? Pyrrha raised one eyebrow.
Does Cam let you do that?
No, but I just want to sit outside number 302. They play the radio and we don't have one.
Sounds harmless. What's Camilla's objection?
She says they're maniacs.
Go. Take 5. I won't tell her if you don't get shot, said Pyrrha.
Nona unlatched the door and tiptoed outside, even though she had been granted permission. The desire to listen to the radio at number 302 was only a mild blind. She knew that if she hung around, the question of the remaining mouthful would come back into play, and she wanted a moment to walk by herself and think by herself. The corridor lights were dimmed and the cool linoleum under her bare feet felt sticky with each step, and condensation left perfect Nona-shaped footprints on the squares as she went. The windows were all blinded and boarded, so she could not crack one and get a breath of fresh air. But she lolled outside number 302. The radio was on, and was playing something mournful she could not really translate. Nona always found listening to the radio much harder to understand, with no mouth and no eyes. She sat there in the moist, dim corridor night, thinking escapeful thoughts. She wondered if she quite had the bottle to go down the stairwell and down to the garage and check to see if anyone she knew was down there. But that felt like more of a betrayal than she wanted to truck with. Outside number 302, she found a window that had only been taped up most of the way,
and peeled it off just a little bit more with her fingertips. The sun had set. The nighttime light was blue from the sphere that hung over the city, and she let the light touch her eyes and her lips and felt better for it. This was a secret that Nona kept from Pyrrha and Camilla and Palamedes, almost the only one she kept from them, but one too beautiful to tell. She knew the luminous sphere hanging above the city, high in space, had kicked off all the riots and was making everyone scream, and had caused the siege in the port, and made people throw themselves in front of buses, and made everyone say the end of the world was coming soon. It was making everybody's lives horrible, and it had given Palamedes and Camilla the same grave, pensive expression. And Pyrrha slept on an extra nicotine patch every time the fog burned away, and it hung like a great blue ball in the sky. But Nona loved the blue sphere as much as she loved everything else. She and nobody else could hear it sing. "Good night, Varun," she said. When she tiptoed back down the corridor, the whole building seemed still tonight, as though it were tucked into a dark corner, hoping nobody would notice it. She opened the door as quietly as she could. There was nobody in the front room. Nona heard the slopping sounds of Pyrrha in the bath. She walked on the balls of her feet to the bedroom, and she found Camilla in front of the recorder with the single lamp on. Camilla, with her arms clasped around her knees, her chin sunk down to the tops of her thighs, staring greyly out into space. Nona lay down on the mattress. She felt very tired and sad all of a sudden, seeing Camilla tired and Camilla sad. On some impulse, she opened her arms, and Camilla unexpectedly lay down next to her and crawled inside them, not quite letting Nona hold her, but letting Nona put an arm around her. Putting an arm around Nona in return. It was hot, but Nona didn't mind. "Cam," Nona whispered.
"What's up?"
"I could go to the park for you," whispered Nona, desperately trying to sort through the words, say the correct thing, communicate the right desire. "I could help, really. You know what happens when I get hurt. That's got to be worth something." Camilla said,
"Is that your plan? Getting hurt?"
"Well, it might freak them out," said Nona. "And I'm not scared of dying. Really, truly, Cam, I'm not."
"Why not?" said Camilla.
Nona thought about it. "Because I like letting go of the pull-up bars and falling off," she said. "I don't like the part just before you let go, and I don't like the part where you hit the floor. But I like the letting go."
"I don't let go," said Camilla. "It's my one thing."
Nona was amazed at that. The idea that Camilla, who could do so much and do it so fluently, could sum herself up as having one thing. Amazed, too, a little, that anyone might not love the weightlessness when your fingers slipped off the metal and you hung unsuspended in midair. Camilla's hand wound itself around the end of her braid and held it, as though to find some kind of leash or safety rope, as though Nona really might fall. She was half asleep by the time Pyrrha finished with her bath and rinsed the bath down twice. This meant it was Nona's turn to take a bath. So she undressed herself half asleep and would have been all the way asleep in the water once she got in if Camilla hadn't been there saying every so often, "Not yet," which kept her awake, because it would have been terrifically stupid to drown at this point. She was three quarters unconscious, pulling on the shirt she slept in, and stumbled out of the bathroom, but didn't quite get it all the way so that Pyrrha had to say,
"Tits, Nona, don't give Camilla a heart attack,"
which jolted her awake enough to lie down on the mattress and rebutton her shirt from the bottom. She reached nearly all the way up before she fell deeply and completely asleep.
John 5:18. In the dream, night had fallen, or what she assumed was night.
They were lying atop the hill they had climbed, and he was pointing out all the constellations that they would be able to see if it weren't for the thick green cloud and the softly falling flakes of ash. They were lying head to head, their eyes aimed at the right part of the sky to see, or in this case, not see, the Southern Cross. The stars were sweet and familiar, but she did not know their names, though they seemed to be at the tip of her tongue. She asked him why it was called the Southern Cross. He said that was just one name for it, but the stars were in a cruciform pattern, and it was only visible from the southern hemisphere. He said when he was little he'd been taught it was the anchor of a ship. He still preferred that, he said. Liked the idea that the Milky Way was pinned down and couldn't go anywhere. Said when he was a kid he hated change, any change at all. She had quite liked change, mostly. But he did not want to dwell on that. So she asked him about the fingers trick, and he was happier to talk about why it had upset everyone so much. He said,
"Keep this in mind. It was the first time anyone had ever done it. You couldn't explain it away. There were no strings or magnets, no illusion of the witch or whatever. I would repeat it for anyone who wanted to walk in and deal with them, dry-retching in the corner. And I did. Everyone had to come watch, the whole gang. And by then..."
He said,
"By then it was easy. By then I had Titania and Ulysses sitting up. By the end of the day, they were walking around with me, sitting down when I sat or standing when I stood. It gave the others the absolute shit. Again, I didn't mean to be a creep. I just wanted them close so I could look after them. It seemed so important. And A was right. I wasn't operating on a lot of food or sleep."
He said,
"Everyone had a big fight over what it meant. C and G took it fine. Funny in hindsight that they were the ones who were the least weirded out. C had been raised Little England Anglican, and G's grandparents, who raised him, had been religious as hell. White Sunday and suit and tie for church, that kind of thing. It was M who couldn't take it. M had been hard atheist since she was 12, but she got over it. She was a walking contradiction anyway. Her best friend in the whole world was a nun. Also, at some point, A gave her a benzo and a shot of whiskey, so that helped."
He said,
"But you know what? They wanted to believe, all of them. We all wanted a miracle. Everyone wants to believe that God's randomly made them one of the X-Men. We all thought of you right away, what it could mean for you. P was worried that this was some kind of zombie apocalypse, but Titania and Ulysses weren't zombies. They were extensions. Constructions without a soul. They hadn't woken up. They hadn't resurrected in that sense of the word. Their bodies moved when I wanted them to move, and then I stopped having to hold the strings. I could say, 'Go here,' or 'Go there,' and they'd go like I'd programmed them to. You had to make sure you told them to stop, or they'd keep walking into things. It wasn't like they could talk or bite you, you know. I wish they could have, but they were just me."
For a moment they were both silent, brushing ash off their faces, their hair. It was falling thick and fast like snow. They took shelter beneath a burnt-out tree and watched the ash hump up against the rocks and branches. Some of it got in their mouths. After a moment he said,
"I knew it was fine. I knew I'd touched something, come away with something that could be used for good, could be used to fix everything. Used for you. I only had to figure out how. There was so much to figure out, but I'd got a dream team on tap, eh? People who could think. See, Zen, she was on board. See, was still pretending they weren't dating. She was an artist, so that was cool. If you have two scientists and an engineer and a detective and a lawyer and an artist, you're pretty much sweet as. Sounds like the start of a joke, right? Two scientists, an engineer, a detective, a lawyer and an artist walk into a bar to help me become God.
He said,
"They put me through my paces. I was exhausted all the time. We all came up with trials to figure out what I could do, what I couldn't do. There was too much to go on. We figured out early that what really helped was if I was near the dead bodies, if I was in the facility. Back then we thought maybe there was something about the ground, something about our particular patch in the Wairua wrappers. But if we loaded up the ute with a bunch of bodies and looked out for the cops, we could do the same thing anywhere else. The corpses were what mattered. They were my batteries."
He said,
"So, of course, what do M and A do? They go raid a fucking graveyard. I was pissed off with them about that. So was P, but, like, mainly because it was illegal and she had to cover it up. But that proved it wasn't that we had a load of specific magical corpses on our hands. I could take a body that had been dead for 20 years and do the same thing. Can't believe we didn't get caught."
He said,
"At that point, we knew that was the biggest risk. Getting caught. Getting hushed up. Getting flown to some government facility in America. Or weaponized. Given to another group of stakeholders or bought by another magnate son of a bitch. I guess we'd seen too many movies. We assumed that we'd all go missing, get disappeared, get used for evil."
He said,
"So we figured that what we had to do was make as big a noise as humanly possible, turn to the public, find out if anyone else was like me, if there was someone out there who could do the same thing. And there was a way we could do just that. It was a different time back then. I didn't want to do it. It felt too kill switch, too awful to contemplate, too grisly, too shitty. But it was the only trick we had up our sleeves."
He sighed and said,
"We had the internet. We decided to stream."
She said, "What is this internet?" And he said,
"See, I did make a utopia."
Day 3. A visit. Crown takes Nona to school. Important news. Hot Sauce and Nona have an adventure. The two princes. 3 days until the tomb opens. 11. The next morning, Camilla pushed the button and said, "Start." Nona did not close her eyes this time, but stared hard at the black mould marks on the ceiling, as though for inspiration, and began. "I'm holding something down in the water. It's the same water, the good water. But whatever I'm holding doesn't want to stay down. It keeps coming back. To the surface, I mean."
"What are you holding?"
"The girl with the painted face."
"Tell me about the girl."
"She's under the water. She's not drowning, she's lying there. Her eyes are closed, I think. The water's cloudy. But then there's the arms still around me. I think. I'm mixing parts up."
"Show me where."
Nona wriggled around in an attempt to embrace herself. She rolled over frontways on the mattress and attempted to get one arm slung over her neck, the other over her waist. Camilla said to these efforts,
"Demonstrate on me."
Delighted at the opportunity, Nona immediately sat up, ignoring the brief wave of dizziness, and wound her arms around Camilla. She paused halfway and said,
"It's a bit... Are you sure?"
And Camilla said,
"You've shown me before, show me again."
Nona concentrated on how it felt in the dream, as strange and multi-bodied as it was. She was good at the hand and the mouth. She was good at this.
but she hesitated. She said, "I can't do it by myself," and took Camilla's arms. She put Camilla's hand on her hip, put Camilla's other hand on her other hip, splayed her fingers, said, "More. No, there," as Camilla kept up, then reached out to Camilla, like she was drowning, like she wanted to drown. It was nice to be this close to Camilla. Camilla's hands on her were a little clinical, a little unsure. "Okay," said Camilla, once they were locked in this clinch. "Anything else?"
"No. Was that useful?"
"Everything's useful."
Camilla detached one hand from Nona's hip to reach out and depress the button of the recorder, but kept the other in place. Nona liked seeing Camilla up close, liked seeing the lines of her collarbone through the unbuttoned part of her shirt, the naked parts of her arms, her ears. Camilla was so sweetly handsome and good. Nona always wanted to be close to her. Pyrrha said it was puppy love, but Nona knew that puppy love was different. It just made you want to open the puppy's lips and play with the puppy's teeth.
"It's pretty nice like this," Nona said now, and a little doubtfully. "It's funny. I never feel like that in the dream."
"Hmm," said Camilla, and...
"But you said you like it."
"It's not sexy, though."
Camilla's eyebrows went up a little way. "Since when do you use the word sexy?"
"The other day, Honesty said he thought nice shoes were sexy, and Beautiful Ruby said, what, just the shoes? And Honesty said, no, there had to be feet in them. And Born in the Morning got mad and said that Honesty was just being cheap. Everyone had feet."
Camilla tilted her head, unwound herself from Nona. Nona was a little disappointed. Cam's hair smelled so much like nice dust, and took the clipboard back.
"Okay. What do you think is sexy?"
Nona cheered up immediately at being asked.
"The huge old poster up on the side of the building at the end of the street. The one the dairy's in. The old poster for shampoo."
Camilla looked at her for a few seconds too many. "The painting of the two flowers," she said.
"I think they're very sexy flowers," said Nona. "All right, your turn. Tell me what you think is sexy."
"Eating breakfast," said Camilla. Nona lifted up her voice in despair.
"You don't? It's not fair. We're having a heart-to-heart. I'm sharing deep personal thoughts and you just want me to eat."
"Yes, I'm going to talk to the warden."
"Well, ask him what he thinks is sexy."
"No, I already know."
That made sense. "Tell me. I'll eat the whole thing if you tell me," said Nona, enchanted, starting to pull on her trousers but deeply distracted. "Oh, Cam, please, please. I've been so good lately, and when I haven't been good, it hasn't been because I haven't tried. Yesterday was awful. I need to know. I know it'll help my memory. It's like a deep need inside of me. It must be my real self wanting to know, right? So this is work, right? What does Palamedes find sexy?"
Camilla took up the clipboard and the pen and wrote, serene and tranquil, underlining something once, twice. "Strong work ethic," she said eventually. "High test scores." Nona buttoned up her shirt and wriggled on one sock, then the other, contemplating this.
"Okay," she said. "Wow.
Go get breakfast. Tell Pyrrha I'll be along in a moment. How's your hair?"
"My braids are still okay," Nona decided, and then, "Do you know who I am yet? Did that help?"
"Not yet," said Camilla, and bent her head back to the paper. It was a dismissal. Nona waited, hoping for another smile like the one she'd got the other day. Camilla did not glance back at her, and no smile came. This filled Nona with sharp pangs of disappointment. It wasn't as though the smile had kept things perfect up till now. Obviously, a lot of terrible stuff had happened in the interim. But that smile had been a kind of guerdon, a safe